The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I work here in the author events office, and it's my honor to be here tonight to introduce Jeremy Scahill. He is an investigative journalist and the author of the best-selling books Blackwater, an expose of the powerful and controversial private army, and Dirty Wars, in which he revealed the grim consequences of the clandestine battles that make up the new paradigm of American warfare. He was a writer and producer of the Academy Award-nominated documentary film adaptation of Dirty Wars also. He is a two-time recipient of the George Polk Award and has served as a correspondent for Democracy Now! And a frequent contributor to The Nation. With Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, he founded The Intercept, an online magazine dedicated to fearless, timely, necessary journalism. That's me editorializing a little bit, but it is terrific. His new book is called The Assassination Complex, Inside the Government's Secret Drone Warfare Program. And I believe that that title pretty accurately gives you a preface for what this book is about. So let's get right to it. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Jeremy Scahill to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you. It's so great to be back at the Free Library of Philadelphia. I walked in and then I went back to a place where I could sit down for a second and realized I forgot my notebook. That's no problem. I guess I'll speak without a notebook. But I did see a very interesting contrast back there on the walls. The poster from my event for Dirty Wars that I did here a few years ago is right next to the poster for Eric Prince, the founder of the Blackwater Mercenary Company. They literally are right next to each other. So my old friend and I are back again. I don't know if anyone was at his event when he was here, but that probably was interesting. Of course we're in the midst right now of a presidential election, and before I came over, I was watching a little bit of CNN, and much of the news about the election today is Don King, boxing promoter, introduced Donald Trump at an event that was intended to reach out to African American voters, and the big focus is on how Don King used the N-word in sort of praising Donald Trump. But there was someone that I think is far more significant to this election that was sitting behind the podium when Don King was there and when Donald Trump ultimately spoke, and that's one of Trump's top military advisors, General Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn has emerged as, well, I guess you could say Trump's trump card when it comes to trying to claim a credibility greater than Hillary Clinton's on foreign policy issues, particularly on counterterrorism. Michael Flynn is one of the most notorious figures within the rise to prominence of what I clearly call the U.S. assassination program. He was one of the top people that was running the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, during the time when General Stanley McChrystal and then Admiral William McRaven were dramatically expanding the number of covert operations that the U.S. was conducting with U.S. military forces. Really about a year into Obama's presidency, we saw a great bit of latitude given to them that they hadn't enjoyed since the early days of the post 9/11 reality, when George Bush and Dick Cheney were given this authorization, as they interpreted it, to wage war on the world. And the notion that Rumsfeld discussed about in secret documents that have been declassified, that the world is a battlefield. And that vote in October 2001 still remains the justification that's used by President Obama for waging what they generically call the war on terror, or war against terrorism or counterterrorism campaign, a contingency operation, sometimes the Democrats prefer to call it. But Michael Flynn was there from the very beginning and was really one of the people credited with coming up with this concept at JSOC that in order to fight networks and groups like Al-Qaeda, that the U.S. military itself has to start thinking like them and also adapting to their tactics by adopting some of their tactics. And so that's really when you started to see very serious targeted assassinations, but also a increasing reliance on drone warfare. And, you know, Flynn falls into the category, and I've interviewed Michael Flynn. I mean, Flynn falls into the category of people like General Jerry Boykin, who is an avowed Christian supremacist, who was one of the leaders of the U.S. campaign in Somalia in the early 1990s, and then has risen even in retirement through the ranks of prominence within the special operations community to be seen sort of as a kind of godfather or a don of the special ops mafia. And you know, the special ops community, one operator said, is you shouldn't look at it as military units, but rather a hybrid of a street gang and a country club. And you know, Flynn is one of the original members of the street gang country club, and he is now traveling all over with Donald Trump. And Flynn was in on the classified brief that Trump received after he secured the nomination for the Republican Party, and then did something that no nominee for either major party has ever done after receiving those briefings. He talked about the briefings publicly and said that it was clear to him that the people that were briefing him, you know, were dissatisfied with President Obama, which, and I'm, as I think some of you probably know, I am not a fan in any way, shape, or form of President Obama's foreign policy, but I highly doubt that anyone in those meetings said anything to Donald Trump about dissatisfaction with President Obama. And I think that, you know, the fact that he's there and he has as his top military advisor, you know, not a you know, a general who's who's sort of storied in the ways of of conventional warfare, or as a military strategist, and in terms of how diplomacy and military operations are meant to be together or apart at times. He has someone that really is used to having carte blanche ability to assassinate people, and that is the person who has his ear. And you know, it could be that he's basically preparing for Michael Flynn to become the Secretary of Defense or the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And that's a very important development for people to watch. And yet, when you sort of watch the coverage of these campaigns, Jimmy Fallon tussling Donald Trump's hair, you know, Hillary Clinton being sick, and does she have epilepsy, and what are her, you know, blue sunglasses? And I'm not saying that some of these aren't, you know, relevant stories. I mean, the health of a presidential candidate, of course, is relevant. But how is it that in a sea of cable news that you can't escape Wolf Blitzer? I think there's probably five Wolf Blitzers that are just, you know, recycled or something. It's like the gnomes that live in CNN, and they wheel each of them out, and they've all been made to. It's like Saddam's body doubles. I think Wolf Blitzer has many body doubles, so because he seems to always be on when you turn on the television. But that they don't have time to actually explain who is advising these candidates on some of these major national security questions, or questions about terrorism or counterterrorism, and what the approach of the United States is going to be. And it indicates to me that Trump definitely has his eyes set on a potential war with Iran, most certainly is going to expand the kinds of bombing campaigns that we're now seeing the U.S. waging in both Syria and Iraq, but also take everything that Cheney and company love about what Obama has legitimized in terms of drone strikes and assassinations and night raids and covert operations, and then reunite it with the idea that torture is an acceptable form of conduct for U.S. operatives to engage in as they pursue the fight against terrorism around the world. Now, you know, I think it's very to go after Donald Trump is low-hanging fruit. I mean, he is at times a quite overt fascist in in his speeches and in some of his policy positions. His advisors are all very extremist characters. He definitely is at a minimum dog whistling to white supremacists and the Ku Klux Klan. At times, it seems that he's overtly sort of encouraging violence from his supporters against Black Lives Matter activists or others who are not down with the Trump program in the middle of his rallies. And I think that if Trump were to win the presidency, he would basically outsource large portions of American policy to a dangerous cabal of people who have more experience than he does on these matters. And that cabal of people, including Michael Flynn, I think are cause for very great concern. But if we look at Hillary Clinton and we assess what would a Hillary Clinton presidency look like in comparison to a Trump presidency, I mean, obviously we would have a person who is not a clown in the sense that Trump is, you know, ruling the country and talk, you know, the idea that, oh, we're going to make bombs great again. We're going to make America great again. We're going to do, you know, we're going to make white supremacy great again. I mean, Hillary Clinton is a very sophisticated political operator. The reason, clearly, that George H.W. Bush endorsed her, and I don't believe it was an accidental thing that came out, and then Barbara Bush after him, is, well, in part because of, you know, what he did to Jeb Bush during the debates and also this, you know, the way that he went after George W. Bush's record, which, by the way, I agreed with some of Donald Trump's criticisms of George W. Bush. I just wish they were coming from a position of principle rather than it was the last thing that someone whispered in his ear that he should say in the debate. But also because the Clintons and the Bushes, that's the United States version of royal families. And I think that the so-called traditional conservatives, people like Brent Scowcroft and the Bushes and Colin Powell, although I don't think he's a great fan of Hillary Clinton, is definitely indicated that she would be a much more qualified individual for the presidency. I think that, you know, what we're really seeing here, or we're getting a brief glimpse into how the empire preserves itself. And what's very interesting is that Hillary Clinton has received the endorsement of a number of very prominent neoconservatives who were really part of the core brain team that came up with the concept of the Project for a New American Century and this idea of regime change and redrawing the maps of the Middle East, the Wolfowitzes and the Rumsfelds of the world. Now, Rumsfeld is with Trump, and Wolfowitz hasn't declared, but you have the Kagans, who are major intellectual sort of fruit bearers of the neoconservative movement. Max Boot, who has never met a war, he doesn't want someone else to fight. You have a number of publications, Bill Kristol, The Weekly Standard, that are endorsing Hillary Clinton, and there's this whole Conservatives for Clinton movement. Now, I don't view those people as sort of brave, bold individuals in a time of a potential horror in Donald Trump. She is their preferred candidate. Maybe not on some domestic issues, and maybe not everything about how she would conduct American foreign policy or diplomacy, but make no mistake about it, Hillary Clinton is the candidate of empire, not Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton is perceived by the defense industry, the war industry, as the safest bet for their profits, not for the world. And that's why Hillary Clinton is just killing Donald Trump on contributions from large defense corporations. And it's why she's getting the support of the elite of the Republican Party foreign policy establishment. You know, Donald Trump can cart out people from the military and say, well, here are these 17 you know, former officers or senior officers who are endorsing me. But when you start to look into who many of these people are, they come from a Christian supremacist tradition within the United States military and are not known as being sort of you know, objective observers. They are people that are that have very extremist reputations. Hillary Clinton was a major player in the expansion of the U.S. drone program and the paramilitarization of the State Department's role in the world, where the State Department was often working hand-in-hand with not only the CIA and the U.S. military in terms of getting country permissions for them to come in, but actively assisting in offensive, covert, and clandestine operations. In the book that I'm here to talk about tonight, which was published with my colleagues at the Intercept, we publish dozens of secret and top secret and some confidential and those are all, you know, designations within the intelligence community, documents on the drone program. Several of the documents provide us the first look that we've had into how the official architecture of the assassination program it was designed to operate by those who are running it. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is that we published, for instance, a chart that we call the kill chain, which shows the process by which the United States military goes from identifying and tracking individuals that they want to either capture or kill, and then going through their own military command, and then up through the civilian channels to the president's desk. And Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, was at the very top of that chain with President Obama, signing off on each of the individuals that the president was clearing for death by either drone or, in some cases, night raids. And so one of the things that's interesting about that is that you see that Hillary Clinton knows very well how this, and many, you know, international law experts would argue, how this extrajudicial parallel justice system was built. And yet you don't ever hear her asked about her role in Yemen or Libya. Donald Trump talks about her, you know, disastrous policies in Libya, but mostly he's talking about Benghazi, which is another story. And I think that, you know, Hillary Clinton can be very thankful that the Republicans who were investigating Benghazi are as batshit crazy as they are, because there are real questions there. But because it was just a carnival of cuckoo on Capitol Hill, none of those real questions were actually asked. She wasn't asked about the covert operations that were being run by John Brennan and the CIA or the Joint Special Operations Command. And if you look around, you can find that some of the people in the special operations community have leaked bits and pieces of information out about what was going on prior to the U.S. consulate and the annex being overrun in Libya. So Hillary won't be asked about that. Trump is basically just focused on the idea that somehow Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice, of course it was the two women, Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice wanted Ambassador Stevens to be killed or somehow refused to provide the necessary backup to fight off that attack. Now, I think she should have to answer those questions, and they asked them of her repeatedly for, I think, 11 hours or something, but never asking questions about what may have precipitated or spurred the individuals who laid siege to our missions there and killed the U.S. ambassador and other Americans. And he's alluded to the idea that Hillary's a regime change candidate, but mostly it was Bernie Sanders at the very end who started talking about Hillary and regime change. But the fact is that Hillary Clinton has been a part of this bipartisan, very hawkish foreign policy tradition since her husband was president. And she wants to say, well, that was Bill's presidency, and I'm my own person, so you should take me on my record. Part of that, I think, is fair, except that Hillary and Bill advertised themselves as a co-presidency in the 1990s. And when there's positives to talk about from the Clinton era, Hillary Clinton will definitely focus on that and assign herself a position of centrality to those positions in endorsing them and saying this is what we need more of. But then when it comes to any kind of a critique or a criticism, it's sort of like, well, that was my husband's presidency. So you can't have it both ways. And I think that it's very clear. And I think that the vicious attacks against Hillary Clinton in the 1990s were overwhelmingly motivated by misogyny and sexism. And I think that some of Hillary Clinton's almost unprecedented unpopularity numbers in certain segments of our society are in large part a result of sexism. That doesn't mean, though, that at the same time, Hillary Clinton does not have a reprehensible record on many of the issues, at least that I focus on, when you're talking about the way that the iron fist of militarism backs up the more hidden hand of free market economics around the world. The Clintons and the Bushes have very much in common in terms of their global outlook. And I think that George H.W. Bush's endorsement of Hillary Clinton should not come as a surprise, and it's not some brave move. It's a bit unusual, but there's not some like spine there that should be praised. It's the empire defending its own interests from an unknown individual, on the international stage like Donald Trump. And don't get me wrong, I do not want a Donald Trump presidency. And I don't tell people who to vote for, and I'm not saying, oh, you should feel bad about voting for Hillary Clinton. My view of it is that I don't understand people who are like really enthusiastic, like, oh my God, I'm with her. Oh my God, I'm with her. I don't get that mentality. I do get strategic, I'm voting for her, or I want our first woman president. I guess that I get that, and I respect that. But if you actually break down the policies and look at it, it kind of reminds me of when Obamacare was first being debated and some of the polling that was done around the issues of Obamacare. Now, me personally, Obamacare is not good for me. It's not good for a lot of people. I know my premiums are skyrocketing. However, for many people, Obamacare is a lifesaver. For people that are at the bottom rungs economically of our society, for young people who are just getting out into the world that need to stay on their parents' insurance, for people with pre-existing conditions, there's many people within our society that will benefit from Obamacare, including many or most, if not almost all of the people that congregate at the saddest gathering of people who vote against their self-interest, the Republican National Conventions. If the people there are asked individual questions about Obamacare and what they think about it, most of them support the core tenets of Obamacare, if it's not called Obamacare. And if you're just asked on a policy level, do you support this, do you support this, do you support this? And yet, even with that being the case, there was this huge obstruction, attempts to overturn it, of course, at the Supreme Court, and some successes in doing that, and maybe they will succeed in doing it. I raise that not to give a lecture about healthcare, which I know about primarily as a consumer of our healthcare system and as someone who has a very large Irish Catholic family. But it's a helpful way of looking at elections, too. If you were to go through and you were to ask people about some of Hillary Clinton's foreign policy positions, but you didn't say they were Hillary Clinton's, and you said that either Trump or Hillary or both of them believe this, or this is their policy, what a lot of people would find is that Hillary Clinton would be okay with Hillary Clinton doing it if they knew it was Hillary Clinton doing it. It's almost as though there are Republican cruise missiles and Democratic cruise missiles. Under the Obama presidency, you had this incredible surge in support for U.S. drone strikes. And I think part of that, especially among self-described liberals, at one point it was I think just under 3/4 of self-identified liberal Democrats said that they support drone strikes, and their support for drone strikes dropped only negligibly when the target in question was an American citizen. I don't believe for a second that those poll numbers among self-described Democrats would have been anywhere near that level had John McCain won in 2008 or Mitt Romney won in 2012. I think that there was this sense that, well, Obama's waging a smarter war, that I just trust him. I just trust him part, no matter how much you like a political candidate, is a very dangerous thing in a democracy, because you're ultimately ceding a significant part of your own conscience or your ability to determine right or wrong to someone else to make those decisions for you. If you view presidential candidates as the answer rather than a strategic part of how we live our lives in a democracy, who we want to support and who we don't support, then it really chisels away at what is necessary in a democratic society, which is critical thinking over partisanship or this idea that you want to promote your group of people more than others. You can make an argument, well, that on whole these people are better, so I'm always going to vote for them. But what if they start to change? And we've seen that. Many of Obama's policies are like a moderate Republican from the 80s. Many of his domestic policies, his foreign policy, is extraordinarily militaristic. I mean, Nixon was to the left of Obama on many domestic issues. Foreign policy, it's hard to compete with the level of criminality of Nixon and certain other things about Nixon. But we have in Obama a president who, expanded the number of places where the United States was engaged in bombing campaigns. He dramatically increased not only the number of drone strikes, but the frequency of them, the number of countries where they were occurring. He relaxed some of the standards for killing individuals whose identities were not known, the so-called signature strikes. There's two kinds of drone strikes, a personality strike and a signature strike. Personality strike, you know who you're going after, you find them, and you try to kill them. Signature strike is you're spying, you're monitoring metadata, you're looking at who is this person in contact with, were they in this place at the same time as these other SIM cards were there, or this handset from a mobile phone was there, or are these people emailing with each other, and you don't necessarily know who they are, but if they're in a certain area of Pakistan, and they happen to be a military-age male, and they're with other people in Pakistan or Yemen in a certain area, then it's okay to take them out on the presumption that they probably were terrorists. And that is something that really was kind of, it was dreamt up in the waning days of the Bush presidency, and then Obama was briefed on it and ultimately gave the go-ahead to conduct those kinds of operations. And what began to happen when in the early stages of Obama's presidency, of his first term, is that here's a guy who had very limited foreign policy experience when it came to government. I mean, he was on the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Senate, and he himself has an international story, and he had tried to bolster his credentials by doing some travel. But you know, generally speaking, he was a guy that was focused more on domestic issues and community organizing issues and racial justice and economic justice issues, all incredibly important. But he wasn't known as the big foreign policy guy. He gave a very carefully crafted speech in opposition to the Iraq War in October of 2002. It was delicate, careful, targeted at the idea of Bush and dumb wars, and it was not some break from the tradition of U.S. militarism. You know, this is a guy who really thought carefully, and his advisors thought carefully about who they wanted him to be when it came time to run for the presidency. But he then comes into office after winning, and when he's briefed by, you know, the dozen and a half intelligence agencies that we know of in existence in this country, they do what they do with every president, Democrat and Republican. They overwhelm them with the possibility of disaster and terrorism and homegrown threats and what Russia is going to do and China is going to do and emerging threats in Yemen and Somalia and the idea of blowing up airplanes and blowing up nightclubs or going after subways. And all of these are things that exist in the world, and we're seeing it now. I mean, this they just found another pressure cooker in New York. I heard on CNN as I was coming here under a bridge, and I guess it would be north of Harlem near Washington Heights. These things are real, but we have to keep context about them. You know, more people die in bee stings every year in this country than die in acts of terrorism. And with the exception of Monsanto, I don't think anyone is trying to kill all of the bees. But it's not that it doesn't exist. It's not that this state, this nation, whether we have a Republican or a Democrat in office, it has a right to defend itself. But that's not what they're doing when they meet with the President of the United States in those early days. What they're doing is what the national security state does best. They are preserving their own institutions and their own viability. And so the job of these briefers early on is to overwhelm the incoming president in such an intense manner that he's going to allow this all to continue without much resistance. And the incredible thing, you know, people who talk about, oh, well, what if there was a coup in this country, or, you know, the corporations are telling the politicians what to do? That's our electoral system. That's how it works. It's legalized corruption, or legitimized corruption in this country, where corporations purchase elections on behalf of individuals. And then, you know, like Donald Trump said, I buy politicians for $10,000. I believe him. I actually think it's one of the handful of times he's telling the truth. They aren't that expensive, but for ordinary people, it is expensive. So corporations can purchase them. But the national security state, it doesn't need to run for re-election. It doesn't have to have a Senate confirmation. It is this massive bureaucracy that has extraordinary power over who we are as a nation. And it can wait out any Democratic election. Even if we had a president that we thought of as truly transformative on these core issues, that actually wanted to take seriously the warnings of Eisenhower, or flashes of sort of what Kennedy said up to Dulles, you know, the idea that Kennedy, you know, wanted to smash the CIA into a million little pieces. Kennedy, his presidency was very complicated, but you don't do that to the national security state. And so when you have someone like Obama come in, and the generals and the admirals and all these covert operators are saying to you, if you don't continue these authorizations, if you don't allow us to hit harder here, there's going to be another attack inside of the United States. You know, is Obama going to stand up and say to all of those people, stand down, we're going to stop all of this and put the brakes on? No. Not because they would kill him. I don't believe that. But because that's not who he is. That's not who the Democrats are. The Democrats are that. They are part of that machine, just like the Republicans are part of that machine. And every presidency of history shows they all are on that same team. So you know, this idea, oh, well, wait till Obama's second term, then the real Obama's going to show up. No, we've seen the real Obama for all of this, both good and really bad in the case of a lot of foreign policy questions. The same is true of Hillary Clinton. If someone said to me, I'm voting for Hillary Clinton just because Supreme Court justices, I get that completely. Donald Trump appointing Supreme Court justices is a horrifying prospect. I'm less concerned with, like, who are you going to vote for and do I have to hold my nose, than, like, what are we going to do about these core issues? The idea that Dick Cheney's, you know, greatest dreams of having this be accepted, that we are a country that can bump anyone off around the world whenever we want, however we want to do it, that we can continue to snatch people off of streets based on very minimal evidence. Yes, Obama ended extraordinary rendition, still continuing rendition. Yes, Obama says, well, CIA can't torture. Now they'll have other third country nationals torture people, you know, for the United States. So is there a difference? Is there a difference in tone? There is. Did anything fundamentally change? No. We're surging back again in Iraq now. Afghanistan, oh, well, we were going to leave. Now we're going to be there for a while under the auspices of counterterrorism. We're giving cluster bombs and white phosphorus to the Saudis and intelligence to the Saudis to destroy what in Yemen? Who are they even fighting in Yemen? I mean, I've spent a lot of time in Yemen. It's one of the most ancient civilizations preserved on Earth. And the Saudis are just bombing it like it's some kind of a shooting range in their backyard. And they're doing it all with the assistance of the United States. It is basically like the United States is doing this, but the democratic way. We'll give them the munitions, the weapons, the intelligence, the targeting data, and weapons that are banned under international conventions like cluster bombs and white phosphorus, and let them go at it. We are in all of these wars, and that's exactly what Cheney and Bush sort of wanted the case to be, but they got a bonus in Obama because he's a Nobel Peace Prize winner. He's a constitutional law scholar. He was a transformative character in American politics who was going to operate the most transparent administration in history, and he has made it possible for this to continue on in perpetuity. If a Republican were to win, and Hillary is lucky that Donald Trump is her opponent, because I think if they had run a serious person, I think that she would probably lose the election. I think she will probably win narrowly unless something cataclysmic happens in the next 50 days. But the next time a Republican is in office, what are Democrats going to say? Oh, well, we only believe in Democratic presidents assassinating people who haven't been charged with crimes, whose identities we don't know, and who we're only targeting based on their metadata on their phone or Facebook or Twitter or whatever it is that they're posting. You know, Cheney can cry, you know, as much as he wants about how horrible Barack Obama is. But quietly, those guys are glad that he did what he did because he legitimized their criminal enterprise and cleaned up the sort of program for Congress and others in the U.S. government bureaucracy to a point now where it's just an acceptable part of the United States that we have a secret process that involves largely unelected people developing what are called baseball cards of suspected terrorists, and they put their statistics on them, you know, we believe to be attached to this group, and they were in this place, and here are their known associates, and maybe, you know, this person was a facilitator of an IED that was used to try to attack U.S. forces in Helmand Province. You know, they have those things, and they call them baseball cards, and we have these in the book. And then those people get nominated. You know, usually nominations are a good thing. You know, you get nominated for a position somewhere or for an award. Well, this is getting nominated for a secret judicial system where you can get the death penalty and not know you've even been convicted of anything, and this is the process that now is basically set in stone as a power and an authority of the executive branch of the U.S. government. where you have individuals who mostly are at the deputy level within the State Department, Department of Defense, the CIA, et cetera, reviewing these baseball cards and then making recommendations that then go higher to the cabinet level officials, including the Secretary of State. So now John Kerry is doing this, before him Hillary Clinton was as well. And they review these people and decide who they believe is worthy of death. And they make their recommendations along with the National Security Advisor to the President of the United States, who then signs off, and we have all the documents that show this, signs off on killing those people. Now, the New York Times and other publications have reported that Obama signs off on each strike. That's not true. He signs off on each individual person who they are going to target in a strike. And if they're going to do certain strikes where there's unknown individuals involved, it's brought to the president, and the president reviews it and then gives his up or down. And so what these documents reveal in the way that it's almost like the banality of a corporate slideshow at times. And in fact, parts of the documents were prepared by the National Security Division of the IBM Corporation. It basically shows how we do have this system where the president and a small group of people serve as the prosecutor, the jury, the judge, and ultimately the executioner who metes out death overwhelmingly by drone strike. And under President Obama, that is going to be one of the legacies. It's not about the drones. And the opening sentence of this book is that, you know, that drones are a tool, not a policy. The policy is assassination. And, you know, it's interesting because if you go back and you try to find when Congress debated the issue of assassination, you can go back and look at there was, you know, House committees looking into assassination, political assassination. Congress has never legislated this issue. There is no law on the books that says the United States does not assassinate people. That's a common, you know, misconception. There is an executive order that was signed by Gerald Ford when, by the way, Cheney and Rumsfeld were working in his administration. Rumsfeld was the youngest and the oldest U.S. Defense Secretary in history. But at the time Ford signed this, and it seems kind of strange, why would Ford sign an executive order banning assassination? Republican president, came out of the Nixon era, has people like Cheney and Rumsfeld around him. Well, it was a very sophisticated chess move, because what they did, it was a way of basically trying to shut up Congress. And it was a response to the fact that Congress was establishing these intelligence committees that were going to have oversight of the Central Intelligence Agency, which the CIA did not, under any circumstances, want. And so if they had gone to Congress and said, well, how should we legislate this issue so that it's clearly defined in law, what we can and can't do, then they're going to have big trouble. But also Congress didn't want that, because Congresspeople generally don't want to ask questions to which they don't want to know the answers, because then they have to do something with that information that they get by asking questions that the answers are going to be a little bit problematic for them. And so they came up with this idea, and they were obsessed with the notion of a unitary executive from the Federalist Papers, the idea that when it comes to national security policy in the United States, that Article 2 of the Constitution is all we need, the Commander-in-Chief Clause, and that essentially Congress's only function should be to fund these operations when the president requests them. And, you know, Cheney and Rumsfeld really do believe that that's how things should work, that the executive branch is effectively a dictatorship when it comes to foreign policy, except when Obama's in office. Then they only want part of it to be a dictatorship when it's the things that they like. But by doing that, and then every president since Ford has upheld this executive order saying that the United States does not engage in, first it said political assassination, then Jimmy Carter removed the word political and it was just assassination, and Carter also added contractors to it, meaning anyone working on behalf of the United States government will not engage in assassination. And all presidents all the way through Obama have signed that executive order. And so, you know, some people, including activists who are opposing this, will say, oh, well, it's banned, assassinations are banned. No. It's sort of like Nixon saying, you know, if the president does it, it's not illegal. None of these are assassinations in their mind. You know, killing someone in an open field, you know, with a missile, who has no weapon and is not like shooting at anyone, and who a person you're intending to kill, who you haven't charged with a crime. I mean, this is assassination. What is the big difference between walking up to someone in a cafe and shooting them in the head and blowing them up in a field off of a declared battlefield? I mean, it is assassination what we're engaged in. But instead, they'll call it something else: a targeted strike, a targeted killing. They'll say that this is justified because they were members of an affiliated group or an associated group. And they've redefined, and we put this document in the book too, the Justice Department has redefined the word imminent in the phrase imminent threat to such a degree that anyone with even base knowledge of the English language wouldn't recognize the definition of the word imminent. Because it's basically, if someone has ever had a thought about anything that we don't like in the world, then they're an ongoing and imminent threat. I mean, it's not exactly what I just said. I'm making a not funny joke, but if you read the actual definition that the Justice Department put forward, it basically is like if you've ever been affiliated with any terror organization or militant group, or you've ever posted things that are praising the killing of American officials, or then you are considered an imminent threat. Even if you live in the middle of nowhere Mountainsville, Yemen, and have no ability to attack anyone in any way except for your neighbors, you still can be killed with the justification that you represented an imminent threat. And now, it's not that there aren't terrorists in Yemen. Of course there are terrorists in Yemen. There are the underwear bomber received his training in Yemen and boarded a plane, from the Nigerian kid, and he flew to the United States and attempted to detonate a device, as the plane was coming into U.S. airspace to go and land in Detroit. And I think that the Obama administration handled that case exactly as it should have. Terrorism is a crime. Attempting to blow up an aircraft is a crime. We should not have sent him to Guantanamo. In fact, they did invoke a national security exception and did not Mirandize him right away because they wanted to make sure that there weren't other threats ongoing. But it wasn't someone ripping out his fingernails and waterboarding him. It was interrogating him through the FBI and constitutionally provided means to try to extract information about what his network was. And they did do an effective interrogation of him, and he was prosecuted and convicted, and he will never see the light of day again. To me, that is the logical way to deal with terrorism. And yet, that's not how the Soot administration handles all of these cases. Instead, there is a tendency to say, well, we should kill them because we don't have anywhere to put them. Obama doesn't want to put them in Guantanamo. They don't want to send U.S. troops in to arrest these individuals. There's a lot of pressure from the national security state to actually kill these people. And so Obama essentially has sort of said, you guys are in charge, to the CIA's paramilitary division and covert ops division and to the Joint Special Operations Command. He essentially handed over that part of U.S. policy to the ninjas, as they sort of call them. I'm going to wrap up in a second so we can take some questions or comments. But I do want to say that as we're nearing this election, pay attention to any questions asked about these issues. The only time that Bernie Sanders was asked about any of this was by Chris Hayes. Hillary Clinton has not been asked about it, and I don't know what Donald Trump would say. I mean, he would probably say something more radical than I can even think of at this point, if asked about. I mean, he's praised waterboarding and torture and all those things. Bernie Sanders, though, when he was asked by Chris Hayes on MSNBC during one of the last town halls before the race was over, about targeted killings, assassination, drone strikes, and Bernie Sanders said that he supports the policy as it's been implemented by President Obama. And so there you had it. We had no one running for major office in this country that had any radically different position than the others when it came to the notion that this is our right and this is the and that it is in fact right. Not just that it's our right, but that it is in fact right and it's the way to proceed. The only way we'll ever have some kind of a serious debate on these issues as part of our, every 4-year process of going to the voting booth for the presidency is if the debates were opened up and other candidates were allowed to participate in them. Both Gary Johnson and Jill Stein are polling in, low single digits. Sometimes Gary Johnson's up a little bit higher. But Gary Johnson right now is polling higher than Ross Perot was at this point in the 92 election, and Ross Perot was allowed into the presidential debates. And it had a huge impact because his profile was raised. Now, I thought Ross Perot was really crazy, but there were some of his ideas that appealed to some segment of the population, and Perot almost got a fifth of the actual vote, and you know, you could make a case devastatingly harmed George H.W. Bush in that election. I don't know that I think Clinton still probably would have won, but Perot did some substantial damage to George H.W. Bush. Bernie Sanders, when he started his campaign against Hillary Clinton, Hillary wouldn't even say his name for strategic reasons, because she didn't want anyone to pay attention to him or to dignify his candidacy by, you know, acknowledging it. But then there came a point where she had to do it. And then the media started covering Bernie Sanders, and his rallies started to grow. And then he started breaking all of these fundraising records. And it's not because Bernie Sanders is the most charismatic, amazing, transformative person in American politics. He's not. And I mean, I've been around Bernie Sanders. I mean, he's a curmudgeonly, he really had to muster something up to be as friendly as he was on the campaign trail. I was like, wow, this is not the Bernie I've ever been around. You know, he's like, shut up. Anyway, but it was kind of an amazing thing that we saw. And Bernie was a viable candidate for the nomination. And, you know, there are all sorts of reasons why that didn't happen. Some of them shady, some of them just straightforward, many of them just that's how it is with a two-party system with huge corporate influence. But the point I'm making is that it could have almost been anyone in that position with that general set of principles like Bernie. And if people get to hear them in a sort of recurring way, and not just in a clip or showing someone screaming at a demonstration, if the ideas presented by people like Bernie Sanders or Dennis Kucinich or others, if people actually get a chance to hear them on the big stage, then you realize that we're not a country of only, you know, Democrat, Republican, that actually there's a huge swath of people that feel totally alienated or like they're being forced into this kind of narrow selection. So if we had a Gary Johnson from the Libertarians and a Jill Stein on the stage, what would the harm of that be to anyone except the two-party system? What would be the harm of saying, okay, these guys are okay, they're only polling at 4% or 7%. You have to draw a sort of threshold somewhere. But they've made the threshold so restrictive that unless you have endless supplies of money and you have a conveyor belt directly from the pharmaceutical industry or the defense industry, you're never going to get that kind of national polling because no one will know who you are. And it's not about you as a person. It's that no one will hear that there's someone with ideas that really relate to me more than either of those people. So the point being, we can try to say, well, we shouldn't be doing assassinations, and oh my God, there has to be accountability for this, and the United States should ratify an international criminal court and hold its own forces accountable in the same way we expect the former Yugoslavia or Rwanda. You know, I'm all for seeing Bashar al-Assad at a war crimes tribunal, but he should also be there with the people running the proxy war there for the United States and Russia, etc. But that's a controversial thing. That's not how it works. It's victor's justice in the world, or justice for people who happen to have a veto at the UN Security Council or nuclear weapons in their possession. But we can campaign on all of these issues, but unless we get these big corporations out of our political process and open up, it's not saying, oh, I want the Green Party or I want the Libertarians. Open the floor a little bit more, and you know, we have a lot of smart people in this country. Let them listen to what everyone is saying. And I think what we would find is that those two parties would have to do a lot more listening to people. They would have to fight for their continued relevance. They couldn't take the votes of huge blocks of people in this country for granted. There wouldn't just be the, well, I'm going to hold my nose and vote for candidate X. It would be, well, I'm actually going to give it a try this year and vote for this other party. It would radically change things in this country. Not overnight, but it would be a huge scandal for the Democrats and the Republicans to deal with, because it would sort of be like an emperor has no clothes moment when you actually have people that are not beholden to big corporate interests or have not been so immersed in the politics of empire that their personality has become a series of advisors' opinions that you blurt out. You know, in many ways, Hillary Clinton is kind of like a walking, living hedge fund. And Donald Trump is, you know, essence of Hitler. And it's like, it's a terrible choice that we're being told falsely is our choice in this country. But unless we do something about corporate money in politics, it's going to continue to be the choice, maybe not as cartoonish as it is this year, but it's going to basically boil down to it like that. So with that extremely depressing ending, I'm going to pass out the free library gave us razor blades for everyone to take care of business. But I thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to hear questions or comments. We have two very wonderful volunteers here who have microphones. It'd be great if we could have some gender balance or non-gender balance or any way that people identify themselves balance, and not just men speaking.
Hi, thank you for coming tonight. I wanted to ask if you could just make a couple of comments about our relationship with Saudi Arabia and also any comment on Gitmo.
I'm sorry, the last?
On Guantanamo.
On Guantanamo. Well, to start sort of in reverse order, there was this article in the New York Times this morning, or maybe it was the Wall Street Journal, about these three prisoners who were taken by the CIA who are now being categorized as forever prisoners. I think it's possible but extremely unlikely that Obama is going to be able to push through releasing the now we're in double digits number of people remaining at Guantanamo. And I think that's a very disturbing reality. I can talk to you for a long time about why I think that happened and the failures early on within the Obama administration. And, you know, everyone that worked on that issue quietly resigned. Greg Craig and others just kind of left that administration. But the failure to empty it before his time in office, matched with a Trump victory, I think means that they're probably going to start trying to fill it up again or return to that. People like General Flynn are very big on the idea, and it's a clever line, and I think that in part they believe it, but I also think that it's just a political convenience. But the line of people like General Flynn and the sort of operators in the world of JSOC and CIA is we'd much rather interrogate people than kill them in a drone strike. Because if we kill them in a drone strike, we can't ask them questions about who's ahead of them. You know, the number three person gets killed all the time. And it sort of is a joke within that world and sometimes in broader society. But there is some truth to it. Like, you know, don't you want to talk to suspects to try to figure out, are there other people? So I think if it stays open and they populate it, it's going to be cloaked in that kind of language, that it's a smarter way of doing it. And then they'll come up with some alternative reality where they'll say there's a justice system there. So I think that's a devastating failure, especially to just get it before the election, because you know, maybe Hillary Clinton will carry on and close it, but it's going to be tough. It'll depend also on the races in the House and the Senate, and that's all sort of insider baseball stuff that I'm sure we all follow to one degree or another. On the issue of Saudi Arabia, I watch in horror as ISIS and other behead journalists or aid workers, I know a number of journalists who have been killed, both by the United States in the case of Jose Cuso in Iraq, but also by ISIS terrorists. And and I bring that up in relation to Saudi Arabia because I also have watched leaked videos out of Saudi Arabia of their police chopping off the head of an immigrant woman in the middle of the street. And Saudi Arabia is regularly beheading people, and Saudi Arabia is considered a great U.S. ally. The Saudis are at present committing daily war crimes in Yemen, and the United States, occasionally Samantha Power will like say something about, oh, Saudi shouldn't be doing this, and it's really, I want to talk to a psychologist about the tweets of some of these officials in the White House. You're giving them the weapons to do it. How are you then saying, well, they shouldn't be using cluster bombs? Where'd they get the cluster bombs? And the thing is, Saudi Arabia is as corrupt and rotten to the core as many of the places where we're told the next Hitler is there and we need to act now and we need to overthrow them and we need to go after them. We could wake up one day and there could be a coup in Saudi Arabia. And the stories that are going to come out of Saudi Arabia, I wouldn't say that it's like what's going to happen if Kim Jong-un falls in North Korea, but the horrors of what has taken place in Saudi Arabia with dissidents, with women, should be a point of great shame for all of those U.S. officials who've kissed the Saudi ring and held hands with them walking down the street. Countries are convenient for the United States until they're not. Saddam during the Iran-Iraq war, he was our son of a bitch, and that's how he was referred to. The U.S., in fact, I met one of the colonels whose job it was to give Saddam Hussein's commanders targeting points inside of Iran at a time that the United States was arming both Iran and Iraq. We talk about Saddam gassed the Kurds in the north of Iraq. He did it with U.S. Bell helicopters and munitions that were sold to him because the Reagan administration lifted Iraq from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Gaddafi had been a covert ally of the United States on a number of issues for many decades. They tried to kill his daughter. Then Gaddafi's a big dictator. Oh, but maybe we can render some prisoners to Gaddafi. Actually, he's a dictator. We should overthrow him. And so you get regime change. With the Saudis, they are so central to the U.S. agenda, and we have handed over a lot of the intelligence collection in that region to the Saudis, to the point where the CIA is so closely attached to the Saudis that it's almost like Siamese twins, and the fear would be if you separate it, both of them could die, and it's devastating because the Saudis are an atrocious, despicable human rights abusing regime, propped up and backed by the United States and U.S. weapons.
You painted a rather grim picture of our choices in this election. My question for you is, was there any candidate that excited you in the primary system, and is there anyone on the political scene or one that might emerge in the next cycle of the election that you feel would be different and exciting?
Well, I mean, I think that... first of all, I think that Rand Paul was an extraordinary disappointment on the Republican side, and I'm certainly not a Republican, but Ron Paul, who of course ran for the nomination of the Republicans, he didn't run this time, but he ran the last few times, often would make points in the debates that were extremely smart and that I agreed with, very passionately. He also said things and is about things that I find, despicable. But many of his ideas on foreign policy I thought were pretty spot on, coming from a kind of libertarian perspective as he does. There were flashes of that with Rand Paul, but then he made the mistake of way too early selling all of his principles off to various interests of the Republican Party, and as a result was a completely uninteresting candidate on the Republican side. Interesting. I found the debates, past the popcorn. That it was just a festival of nuttiness on the Republican side that was kind of entertaining to watch at moments. And I felt bad for Jeb Bush at times, which also made me feel bad about myself, because why should I feel bad for Jeb Bush? But I did feel bad for Jeb Bush on that stage. I felt like, oh my God, Jeb Bush is such a sane, normal person. And it's like, it was really nutty. On the Democratic side, I always would like it when Dennis Kucinich would be in those debates, but Kucinich, I think, didn't take his own candidacy seriously enough, as Sanders did, and Kucinich basically said, when I spoke to him, multiple times over the years, that he cast his lot with the Democrats. That's what he is, and he's always going to just endorse whoever the Democrat is for president. I bring him up, and I bring Ron Paul up, because I wonder why people like that don't actually run as third-party candidates when they are in the positions they're in, both of them with the capacity to raise tremendous amounts of money, to draw very large crowds. If one of them was running on a third party ticket, it would be game changing. We haven't had any sort of a prominent individual who had any ability to raise funds on either the Libertarian or the Green Party ticket in some time. And then Bernie Sanders. With my reservations about, some of how he had to kind of muster up the personality to do what he did, in general, I think Bernie Sanders really spoke for a lot of people whose voice is not allowed in corporate politics in this country. And I think he ran a really exciting campaign that he ended in an extraordinarily idiotic manner by getting nothing out of his endorsement of Hillary Clinton. And it really is kind of shameful that he blew it in the way that he did. I think that Sanders should have put a serious issue on the table of endorsing Jill Stein and the Green Party. And whether he did it or not, it would be part of a negotiation. But imagine if Bernie Sanders, people would say, oh, well, Sanders is going to be responsible for Trump being president. Bullshit. What was Sanders saying every day on the campaign trail? So much that it drove us all nuts. It's a rigged system. Over and over and over. talking about Hillary Clinton and big money and all this stuff and special interests, only to then turn around and say, well, we got to vote for Hillary because Trump. What if he actually said, and neither of these candidates stand for any of that, and I fooled you, I was only a Democrat for a few months to do this, but I actually am independent. You ask about Bloomberg. I've had, as a New York resident, I haven't enough of Bloomberg. Bloomberg is about as exciting as a soggy potato. And I don't. I think he's so rich that he. I really don't think he. If you ask him, he knows how much a gallon of milk costs. Like when George H.W. Bush tried to buy milk once, and he thought it was like $7. Now it almost is $7. But you know. But I mean, Bloomberg, no, there's no one like that. I think Gary Johnson and Jill Stein are very interesting people, neither of whom ever have a chance in hell of winning, even if they are allowed in the debates, because they're not that, they don't have it, you know, they don't have the fire. So that's why I say people who can capture the imagination have to start thinking about shaking up the system in the third party. But yeah, Bernie was about as good as we've gotten in our generation in terms of a viable candidate who actually came very close to winning the nomination of the Democratic Party, in part because of Hillary's policies and also because of sexism against Hillary. I think Hillary is a complicated person to talk about, just like Obama is. Horrible racism against Obama, horrible sexism against Hillary, but both very deserving of intense, fierce criticism, and they need to be held accountable.
The assassination program, it sort of sounds like a whack-a-mole kind of situation that could go on in perpetuity. I guess that's what the AUMF is sort of designed to allow for. But at these high levels of policymaking, is there any conversation happening about what's the end game? Does it go on forever? And if not, how do we deal with the fact that it just begets more and more of these same issues that it's trying to solve?
I mean, that's a great question, first of all. It's a question we as journalists ask officials or sources who have access to some of those meetings. And if you recall, President Obama did say in what was billed as his first major policy address on targeted killing. This was, I think, 6 years into the drone program being operative under him. He said that it can't go on forever, and that we can't have a forever war. And he said a number of things in that speech that that sound really good and that are good ideas or good principles, but all of the policies that have been put in place indicate that they're preparing for the opposite of that. And what do I mean by that? Well, you know, it was very interesting to look at, and someday maybe there will be a critical biography written of John Brennan, who was really kind of the drone czar under Obama, and of course, career CIA guy, now director of the CIA. First time around, when Obama tried to make him CIA director, Democrats rightly filibustered it because of the issue of his views on torture, or you know, under the Bush era, but then they snuck him in the back door in a non-confirmed position, and he wielded tremendous power. And what he did is he built up, what they call the disposition matrix, this infrastructure for essentially like an algorithm with a little bit of human input for determining who should live and die, who we can capture, how we should capture them, how we should kill them, what the consequences of sending in ground troops would be versus, using a drone strike, things that are calculated on a daily basis by military planners in the battlefield, but it now has been solidified under this administration because they said that they wanted to have accountability. And they wanted it to be effectively a regulated industry. You know, the killing industry is sort of regulated under the Democrats now. That it would be very difficult to disentangle that. And lawyers that I know from the ACLU who have been on the front lines of this and represented people like Anwar al-Awlaki's family, the American who was killed in a drone strike, and his 16-year-old son who was killed in a drone strike 2 weeks later. You know, they've said that they are concerned that if they were to win one of these cases and then it goes to the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court may actually rule that the executive is right and that we do have this right to do this and that we do have a right to kill American citizens in this manner, not to mention any other citizens of the world. I think there is a decent shot that the Supreme Court would say, we're okay with this. And that would be very... very dangerous. The short answer is that I do think that we are now in an age where this streamlined way of compiling information on everyone, databases, metadata, watch listing, all of this stuff, is going to be, rather than rolled back when the so-called wars draw down, but it's going to permeate into our society the same way that the paramilitarization of law enforcement has emerged in a very real way. You know, 1980, when Philadelphia police, dropped the bomb on the MOVE organization, it was this huge thing, and people were, oh my God, it's like a military operation. Now, every time there's protests over these police killings of young African Americans, it's like the stormtroopers are in the streets. And part of that is because we have a program at the Department of Homeland Security to provide local and state law enforcement agencies with military gear that the military doesn't need anymore from their foreign wars. So all of these things find a way of coming home. The mercenaries that were over in Iraq and Afghanistan, they came home. New Orleans, Katrina, disaster profiteering, and now private security forces are growing and growing and growing. The intelligence gathering a real light was shed by Edward Snowden. Local cops now have stingrays, and they have the same kinds of surveillance platforms that are used to, in the words of the intelligence community, track and whack people around the world. That stuff is slowly making its way onto the streets of American cities, being used to track people accused or suspected of everyday crimes. So we can say, oh, well, we're not going to do these kinds of drone operations in this case. The infrastructure is there, that it doesn't matter which toy they're using at any given time or which defense manufacturer happens to be in favor, so their toys go to the front of the line. It's a bipartisan thing that somehow got the stamp of legitimacy from Mr. Constitutional Law Scholar and the celebration of Dick Cheney, which is really scary. So I do think it's a kind of forever, it's going to become a forever part of our lives, whether it's drones or the surveillance or the militarization of the war on drugs or the paramilitarization of policing in general. And I'm really apologize on having to end on such a terribly depressing note, but I do mean it. If anyone has a question or they didn't get to say something, please feel free to come up even without a book. And thank you guys so much, and thank you to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.